Hello. Welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me right now is Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. And we're going to have a conversation about what to get that gardener in your life for Christmas. And I'm a gardener. Mark's a gardener, so we know what we like.
Exactly.
Dear, are you listening? So if you'd like to join our conversation, maybe you have a suggestion, or maybe you're a gardener and would like to suggest something to someone else in your life, 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can also go to our Gmail email and send it to zestygarden@gmail.com. Mark, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thanks for the invitation.
So for me, I think of the tools in my life for gardening that I just could not do without. And the first one that always comes to my mind is a really good hoe, a really good shovel, and then as far as a hand implement, a really good saw. I mean, even if I couldn't, and hand pruners.
Saw or hand pruner.
I can see, I keep going on.
Yeah, saw or hand pruner. There's just certain tools that you should have in your shed if you're going to be doing any gardening or any maintenance outside in your yard. And hand pruner and a saw is like they're essentials.
And not just any hand pruner or saw. You can't just go to a store and get a pair of pruners for $9. Yeah. That's just not going to work. I've used those and it about killed my wrist.
Yep. There's some that are much, much better than others. So if you've got, you know, kind of a particular gardener that likes, you know, nice quality tools, but also something that's going to assist in the work so that you don't have to work as hard, then the better quality tool, obviously, the less work that you have to do. So hand pruner, saw, shovel, hoe, rake, you know, got to have those. And you would hope that somebody would have those already if they had a yard.
So you bring up rake.
Yeah.
And we've got those old, in the barn somewhere, a couple of the old metal rakes.
Yeah.
I bought one at your place that has, it's plastic, but it has wide tines on it.
Right.
Oh, absolutely love that for raking the leaves.
That's a nice
rake.
It is
so good.
Yeah. There's one that's out that's called the Flex Rake. And when you look at it, you go, I don't know. It's kind of small. It's got a smaller head. It's like an 18-inch head, and it's shorter. It's only maybe 8 inches long, but it's got the most flexibility to it of any rake that I've ever used, and it's metal. So it'll hold up for years and years and years, and you can get it with a wood handle or aluminum handle. But those Flex rakes, they do just a really nice job, and it doesn't end up digging into the soil too much. So it's got just the right curve to it.
So is it a big head?
No, the head's only 18 inches, so it's a little bit smaller, but it's got just the right flexibility and just the right tension to it to really do a great job in raking leaves, especially. But you know, we were talking hand pruners and saws before. There's a lot of great companies out there. My personal favorites would have to be Baco. My Baco pruners are just, I can't live without them.
I mean, I've had mine for 20 years.
They're just the best.
And I'm here to tell you, I went and pruned with some old pruners at my aunt's house, and she had like 10 fruit trees that I was working with, and it just, my wrist just died. So I thought, I'm not going to do this again. And I got, that's when I got the really good pruners. And I think it was probably $40, $35 back then when I got them.
Right.
And I couldn't believe the difference.
Huge, huge, huge difference. But
and it's good. It's better for the tree because you're making nice, clean cuts. You're
exactly.
not stripping bark off of the tree.
So, you know, for the gardener that already has a nice pruner, a nice sharpener would be great, and how to use that sharpener so you can keep your tools up to speed. You know, so a bench grinder for your larger tools is almost an essential to be able to keep them sharp. But there's some really nice pruning sharpeners that are out there that are super easy to use that would definitely make life much, much easier. When I think about gifts for gardeners, bird feeders, there's a lot of really nice bird feeders out there and some seed to fill them with. And, you know, it's getting cold enough. The suet feeders are great through the wintertime. And it's really fun. It's enjoyable. It's a way to appreciate the outdoors and appreciate your yard even when we're kind of stuck inside for a little bit. So you can watch out the window and watch the birds come and enjoy a feast. And it's a really thoughtful gift.
I'm a lazy bird feeder.
Yeah.
And this one feeder I had 3 tubes that were maybe 2 inches.
Yeah.
And there were 4 perches on each tube.
Right.
But the birds would just, within a day and a half, they'd all be gone.
You have to fill it back up.
So
again,
I paid a little extra and got a big tube that would, and, you know, it's like 2 feet tall and 8 inches in diameter.
You don't have to fill it up as much.
And there's only 4 ports on it,
so
it doesn't go as fast.
They have to take turns, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Wind chimes. Wind chimes are a great, long-lasting gift that you can enjoy every day, you know, for years. So there's some beautiful chimes, appearance-wise, but also beautiful notes also. And some chimes are more decorative. I mean, they make noise, but they're not as beautiful. If you've listened to, say, Woodstock chimes, they're all tuned, and they're precision-tuned to specific chords. And some of them are beautiful.
If it looks like someone just took some metal piping and cut it,
that's what
it's probably going to sound like. Someone took metal piping and cut it.
That's what you're going to get. But if it's a precision tuned to specific chords and specific notes, they can truly be amazing. So
how do you avoid something that can just? Sometimes you don't want to have the sound too much.
Yeah, yeah. Don't put it in a spot that's too windy.
Okay.
Yeah, because if it's really windy, then it can definitely.
So maybe a more sheltered location.
Yeah, yeah. You want that nice gentle breeze to just kind of hit the chimes. But
so I want to go back to the saw.
Yeah.
So the same company that did the hand pruners.
Yes.
And mine it cuts on both the pull and the push stroke.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
cuts your work in half.
Yeah, and, yeah, really, and does. If I'm up in a tree and I don't have a bigger saw to do a larger limb, this will do in a pinch.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my heaven.
Yeah.
It'll take a little longer to cut through it, but it's still, wow.
So Bahco is actually a Swedish company that was recently purchased by Snap-on. So now they're an American.
Oh, you're kidding. They keep consolidating.
Yeah, now they're an American company. And they just have amazing quality steel.
So did the name change?
No, it's still Bahco.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's still Bahco. But amazing steel, highly refined sharpening techniques and just different methods of the way they create their products. So you just don't have to work as hard and long, long lasting. I mean, I've had my hand pruner with the rotating handle on it for
I've had it for
10 years and it's still just cuts like
it's
crazy.
It's very ergonomically correct.
Yeah, yeah. So it fits your hand just right, and as you close your hand, the handle rotates with your fingers, so it's more of a natural gripping motion instead of kind of a squeezing motion, and it's so much easier.
And that could be really helpful if you have arthritis in your hands.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, as you get older, those joints get a little bit stiffer, and they don't want to work as well, and so having the right tool makes life much, much easier. It really does.
When you're looking for a larger tool like a shovel or a rake or a hoe, now there are different heads that you can have, but how do you know you're getting a good quality tool?
Yeah, yeah, because there's so many different shovels that are out there. So really it has a lot to do with the gauge of steel that they create the tool with, and also whether it's forged or stamped. So if you're looking at a very high quality shovel, it's going to be a forged head, solid back. You won't have like a hollow back on it. You know, when you turn the shovel over and you look at the backside, if the handle sticks out the back of the shovel head, not where the handle comes out to the bottom, but out through the top, that's an open back. And the open backs are a thinner steel. They're not as heavy. They're usually stamped. If it's a solid shank, you know it's been forged out of one piece of steel, and it's actually been hand forged instead of stamped by a machine. I've got customers that have brought in forged shovels that have worn down so far that they've worn 3 inches off the top, and they've replaced the handle 5 or 6 times, but the tool's like 20, 30 years old, and it still is like great. I mean, you just don't break those forged heads. They wear down over time.
Well, I'm being told by my producer that we're running out of time.
Already. How rude is that?
So thank you for coming in. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden has been giving us some ideas on what to get that gardener for Christmas. Real quick, in a gardening calendar item, there's The Messenger. It's a bird documentary. It'll be at the Megaplex University Stadium 6 next Thursday from 6:30 to 8 o'clock. And it's join us for one night of of this timely documentary, which takes us around the world in 90 minutes to understand the changes in our own backyards and what we can do about it. Tickets may be purchased online, and it's the Cornell Lab of Ornithology said it's a must-see movie for anyone. And so information will be at the website at upr.org. Mark, thanks again.
You're welcome. Merry Christmas to all of our listeners.
Welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and today we're going to talk about birds here at the beginning of the program. And I have with me Brian Dixon, who is a compiler for the Logan Christmas Bird Count. He's a member of the Bridgerland Audubon Bird Society and a retired environmental consultant. Brian, thanks for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
I've seen bird count information every year in the paper, and I think I need to do this. I really should do this, and then, of course, I don't get around to doing it. So I'm being kind of selfish here. One of the reasons I wanted you to come in is so I could learn more about it and get me all pumped up about it. But I think you could help others get into doing the count as well. And so let's talk about the date. The date is the 19th.
Saturday the 19th mm-hmm. of December.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So talk about the generalities of the bird count. What will people be doing, and how can a novice be of any help?
Well, we first started doing the Christmas bird count here in the Logan area in 1955, I think. And we've missed 4 years in there, but pretty much we do it every year. There's a window that you can do it in from December 14th to January 5th. You pick one 24-hour period anywhere in there, and we always pick the first Saturday in that window. So the Christmas bird count is, the idea is to count every bird within the same circle every year. So the circle is centered in Hyde Park.
Yeah, I got to back up. I did read on your website it's centered on the Coke machine at
the
Maverick.
Coke machine,
right? The Diet Coke.
The Diet Coke. In honor of the previous compiler, Dr. Keith Archibald.
Oh, okay.
Who was a fan, I guess we should say, of Diet Coke. So I say that's where it's centered in. Because we try to make it fun, even though the Christmas bird count is an invaluable citizen science project. The big reason for most of us doing it locally is just to make it fun.
So how big is the radius?
The radius is 7.5 miles, so a 15-mile diameter. Centered on that. So it takes us up into the mountains, and it takes us north into the meadows and the farm fields, and out west into the Cutler Reservoir and Cutler Marsh. It includes the Logan sewage lagoons. So it was intentionally chosen to represent a broad variety of habitats. And of course, the more habitats you get, the more species you get.
And why in the winter instead of spring, when you're going to have more species?
Well, there are other counts that are done in the spring.
Okay.
This count has an interesting history, and we can talk about that for just a minute. And it really came out. The first Christmas bird count was done in 1900 in New England, and it evolved from people beginning to understand the impacts that we were having on nature in the late 1800s. In particular, there was a fashion to put bird feathers. And actually dead birds on women's hats, as bizarre as that might sound.
I remember reading about the numbers of egrets had plummeted.
Had plummeted. And some people began to recognize that our activities, humans' activities, were having a profound impact on nature. And they were afraid of what we might do.
So this is 115 humans. Years ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's a... Not to get too political, but there's a real message here, which is we shouldn't be condemning those people in the past who have had impacts on nature. We need to look forward. And in this case, that's what they did. There was a custom at the time where you'd have Christmas dinner, and then in the afternoon, you'd take your friends out and you'd go shoot birds, and you'd work in teams. And the team that came back with the most dead birds won.
Any birds?
Any birds. Hmm. You know, so... We would think of that as pretty perverse these days. You know, attitudes and knowledge change. And so what Frank Chapman did, he'd started a magazine called Bird Lore in the 1890s to try to raise awareness for this. He started something, an alternative to that practice. That practice was referred to as the Christmas side hunt. And so he thought that we should be, instead of shooting the birds, we should be counting them. And so the first Christmas bird count was done in 1900, and there were 20-some, you know, parties that went out looking for birds and counting them. And it's evolved ever since. It's spread across the continent, really.
And Utah, it was in Provo, you told me?
The first count in Utah was in 1904 in Provo.
It's just not the first place I'd think of in Utah for the count to start, but mine.
They're enlightened people everywhere.
Yeah.
And so here in Logan, there are four or five folks. I don't have their names on the top of my heads, but they're documented in American Birds. And the old copies of the magazine are down in Merrill Library. I had a librarian take me down there, and we looked at them, you know, one time. Because all this is documented, not just the number of birds, but the number of species and the number in each species and how many people were helping out, who they were, what their names were. And so you can kind of track that from the early 50s or mid-50s when it started.
Trends? What are you seeing in trends in the last? I mean, that's more than 100 years here in Utah. Cache County, you said, started when?
Ours started in 1955.
Okay. So we've got a few decades of history.
We do.
Is it far enough back to determine how much global warming might be affecting?
Not from our count. Because whenever you look at scientific data, you have to look at it in context. And in this case, the number of birds you find and the number of species that you find is heavily dependent on the number of observers that you have and their skill, and also the weather conditions. So if it's snowy and foggy, as it sometimes is in the morning, you might not see very much at all until noon or 1 o'clock.
But you don't postpone it. You still go out.
Still
and do it.
But what you do is you record the weather conditions, and you record the number of observers, and you record the amount of time that they spend observing, and how many miles they walk, and how many miles they drive, you know, how many miles they snowshoe or ski, or what kind of conveyances they use, and you record all that data as part of the compilation data, so that when you look at this, you're looking at it in context. So here in Logan, it's really hard to say what are the trends in species, even in the region, without looking at all of the other Christmas bird counts that are done in this region, and then comparing that with national data, and then adjusting that for weather conditions and level of effort.
So overall, what are some of the important keys, the important information that you get from the count?
For the entire CBC, that's a very important question, and the answer is complex. But the National Audubon Society has started mining this data for themselves to look at climate change, for example, and to look at where the centers of abundance, as it's termed, for various species that are here in the winter, in North America for the winter. And they found a profound shift northward by tens of miles, and also away from the coasts for those bird species that don't rely on coastal habitats. And that's just, you know, answering the question about climate. But a few years ago, you might recall there was concern about West Nile virus and its impacts on birds. And the corvids, the crows, the jays, the ravens, those species were most affected by West Nile virus. And you can see a dramatic dip in the numbers of those birds that were found in the course of several years. But it's recovered, you know, as those birds that were particularly susceptible died and it didn't pass along their genes, perhaps, or as West Nile virus disappeared or was overrun by other prozone species or whatever, then those species recovered. And you can see that in the Christmas bird count data.
I'd imagine that the efficiency of the count is done really well because you do it in the same spot each year and you have a lot of the same people. And so you can divvy up the areas and tell people where to go and,
right,
and as they're walking along.
It's the same 15-mile diameter circle. And we break it up into sectors. So there are 10 geographic sectors. And plus, there's a group of people that are monitoring feeders. So you can participate even in the comfort of your home by watching your feeders. And there's a protocol for doing that.
Hmm.
And so the sector is monitored every year. And so that sector is assigned a leader. And then that leader is assigned people to help them. And so leaders tend to stick with the sector for several years. And so they get pretty good at it. They talk to landowners and get permission to walk on their land and observe birds. And I think I've only had one refusal from a landowner for us to count birds on his ground. And the next year he said, oh, sure, go ahead. So people get familiar with territories, they get familiar with birds, and they get familiar with each other. And so it gets to be something that's really fun. That said, people ask me, well, I'm just a beginner. I don't know very much about birds. You know, can I really help out? And the answer to that is absolutely. One of the neat things about the Christmas Bird Count is that even beginners can be very, very valuable. We need eyeballs. When you're out there with a team of two or three people, as an individual, you can't see every bird. And remember, the objective is to count every bird if you can. And so just someone finding a bird, just seeing it over on the left, where maybe the person who's most skilled didn't see it, you know, so there's a hawk, what is it? And then that person can turn around and identify it perhaps. So beginners are play a really important role in the Christmas bird count.
Is this fun?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Once you get up.
What time does it start?
Well, some folks will look for owls before dawn. And I'm always dragging myself out of bed at 4:30 or 5 o'clock, you know. I mean, it's warm in there and it's cold outside. But there's magic in the early morning. And so once you actually get outside, it's fun even in the dark looking for owls.
And is this a 24-hour count?
The protocol allows you 24 hours. And so most of our team start... those that are owling are starting around 4 or 5, and then we finish up usually around 5 o'clock or so in the afternoon, and it's dark again, and you're pretty bushed. So for all intents and purposes, it's usually about 12 hours. That said, there have been some instances when at 11 o'clock, certain individuals were rolling out trying to find the 100th species, and there's some interesting stories there. So it allows you 24 hours.
So what are some of the interesting experiences you've had in the last 20 years? Just to give our audience some kind of an idea of maybe what to expect.
The compiler before me, Keith Archibald, a dentist in town, was a phenomenal birder and just addicted to this stuff. And he's really the one that got me introduced in this. So a lot of the stories relate to him too. But there are things like trying to find as many species as possible. So we'll, quote unquote, stake out a bird, you know, and in the weeks leading up to it, we'll look for birds. So we'll try to find a hermit thrush. Is there a hermit thrush around, or a winter wren, now called a Pacific wren? And so we'll try to find those birds and then go look for them on that day. And if you can't find them, well, you spend an awful lot of time looking around for them. So there's the individual birds that are really interesting, but then there are the larger flocks too. When we get rosy finches, and we don't usually get rosy finches in on our count, there are more high elevation bird, you know, 10, 11,000 feet, typically in the summertime. But when we get them, we get 3,000 or 4,000.
Wow.
So we never get one rosy finch.
So it's an eruptive species?
It's an eruptive species, right, exactly. I mean, the word is, if you want to find rosy finches in the summertime, go to the Uintas, you know, go to Mirror Lake Highway, you know, and go high. And that's where you look for them. They're there. Right? That's where they'll breed in those high elevations. But around here, it's really not high enough, you know, even in our mountains that are 9,000 and 10,000 feet. So, but in the wintertime, they come down and they're looking for food and they're flocking up. And so when you see them, as I say, you see 3,000 or 4,000. Starlings are another fun species.
I was looking at the list of the total count from each year for the last 20 years, and two numbers jumped out at me, and one of them was like
66,000 starlings.
Well, 66,000. That just blew me away. Well, why is this year there's a total of 85,000 species, and then the years before and after it was like 18 and 26, and you pointed out that starlings was one of those.
In the wintertime, starlings group up. They're referred to as a murmuration of starlings. There'll be this big morphing cloud of birds, and it's just magical to watch them fly. Some people consider them a real nuisance, but you know, they're here on this earth like a lot of other creatures, and so we try to enjoy their beauty. But when they occur, they usually occur in large numbers, and particularly in the wintertime, they're in large flocks, not individually. So that's another bird that we see a lot of. And it's kind of fun.
Well, and how do you count a murmuration of that many birds?
Well, the best thing about it is no one can check you, see, because the birds are all gone. So there's no one actually to contradict what you're going to. Actually, when you're counting large numbers of birds, you count them in groups. And so you'll say, oh, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10. And so you can imagine, you can see those 10 birds. And you say, oh, well, then what's 10 tens? And you can kind of carve out, you know, 100 birds that way. And then 10 100s. So you can imagine 10 of something, you know, visually. And so you just scale it up. And the people who are really good at that, you know, counting shorebirds on the coast, for example, they may count hundreds of thousands of birds, and they can be within 2 or 3%.
Wow. Well, and you had said before the program that you were counting in groups of 5,000 with this particular group last year.
On that particular flock. Yeah, that 65,000 bird flock.
That blows my mind.
That was pretty bizarre. But we'll get a lot of ducks. We'll get thousands of various species of ducks, gadwalls, for example, out on the Logan sewage lagoons, where they feel sort of protected.
So there are different species that come through here in the winter or spend time here in the winter that you wouldn't see during the summer.
Oh, yeah.
So another reason to come out, because you're going to see things that you don't normally see.
And a good example of that we get every year is a rough-legged hawk. So the rough-legged hawks come down from Canada and the Northern Territories, and they're not here in the summer. You're not going to see a rough-legged hawk here in the summer, but you'll see them in the winter. Just as birds move out, a Swainson's hawk moves out in the winter. The rough leg sort of moves in to replace it. And they're both bootios. They have similar kinds of hunting and hunting activities. So
what time commitment should you give to the count? If you want to join into the count and be a part of it, can you do it for a couple of hours? Or would you rather have someone be in the same group and everyone stay together for the 12 hours?
We can usually accommodate whatever time someone has. There are people that can only join it for the morning or the afternoon, or, you know, a couple hours. And if they work with a sector leader, the sector leader, I mean, we have cell phones these days, which makes it so much easier. They can meet up with the sector leader. So before the count, each person who's on the count will be assigned to a sector, and they'll have the telephone number of the sector leader. So any amount of time during the day. But then don't forget the evening. One of the most fun things about the Christmas bird count is the compilation. So at 6 o'clock, we all convene at a central place, and we have a potluck supper. And we line up each of the sector leaders, and we go through the entire count, compiling all the data. So that evening, we'll know how many birds, how many species. And there'll be just some fun stories that come out of that of someone. Because we always go through the birds that are most common. And then at the end, we say, okay, did anyone see anything that we haven't talked about? And that's when the really fun stories come out. And you can see people chomping at the bit to tell everybody else something that they just found.
So, they just can't wait to tell you what they saw.
Right.
Well, I know for me, when I took my son out doing some birding for his birding merit badge, and we were talking about different types of birds, I wanted to show him something different. So he's seen... Canada goose. He's seen a lot at starlings. He knows what a robin looks like. I wanted to show him something a little bit different. So I'm like, okay, let's go to First Dam, because I know there's going to be something there that I've usually seen every time I go by there. And mm-hmm. So, of course, we were able to see golden eyes.
Right. Both barrows, golden eyes.
Both the common and the barrows. Mm-hmm. And he'd get the binoculars out. And the fun part for me was getting out my Sibley field guide and showing him the differences between the two, and then having him get the binoculars and look at the birds and be able to identify the difference between the two.
Right.
So.
Yeah, First Dam is a wonderful place to go for ducks. And I might mention that right now, just recently, and this often happens in December, there will be one or a couple of hooded mergansers there.
And do they stick around all winter, or are they just flying in for a little bit?
Sometimes they're here for very much the winter, for most of the winter. But they're only here really in the winter. We rarely see them in the spring or summertime.
What's the minimum age that you recommend?
For an observer?
For an observer for the count.
We've taken, you know, kids 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, you know.
Just make sure there's a parent with them.
Yeah.
That's the best thing.
Anybody as young like that, we'd want the parent to be there.
Okay. How do you sign up?
You contact me. Yeah, there's a compiler for every count circle, and I happen to be the compiler for this count circle at the moment. So I can give you two contact information bits. One is an email address, and that is bdixon@xmission.com. That's just B-D-I-X-O-N at xmission.com. Or you can call me on the telephone, and the number is 760-0691.
And I will also have a link to the Bridgeland Audubon Society webpage that's on our the UPR webpage. Mm-hmm. Just go to Zesty Garden, and that information will be,
yep,
will be
the
there as well.
Yep, Christmas bird count is announced there, as well as my contact information, so you can get to me that way.
So just go to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and drop down to Zesty Garden, and you'll be able to find the information there. Anything else that we should talk about as far as the bird count? There are other bird counts that are done. In Utah, there are...
There's 24 counts that are 24 count circles done in Utah.
Oh, and just for Christmas.
Just for Christmas count.
Wow,
right.
That's a number of counts. I would imagine there's probably one at the different wildlife refuges. So if you like go mm-hmm. down to Ouray,
right, and there's one in Ogden. I mean, they're all over the state. And if you go on National Audubon Society's website, you can look at the Christmas bird count and find a count near you. So if you're listening here and you're not in the Logan area and Cache Valley area and you want a count. For the CBC, you can find a count circle near you. Or if you're vacationing, if you're for the holidays traveling to Virginia, you know, or wherever, and you want to participate, you can find a count in those places. So it's really fun to have people from other areas of the world join us because they're sensitive to species that we may not be sensitive to.
Are the counts usually all on the same day or... No, within a couple weeks of each other.
It can be any day but in that window of December 14th to January 5th.
Okay.
So it really varies. So there are people that do 2, 3, 4 counts, you know, different counts.
And so in Utah, they're kind of spread around as well during that time?
Yep, there are. I think the Bear Lake counts that Dennis Austin does are typically after Christmas Day. So there's a little bit later count, you know, even nearby.
How many do you participate in?
Usually no more than 2. I usually, by the time I do this one, I'm pretty full. But I've also done the Bear Lake count.
Mm-hmm. What is one species that was just name a species that was totally unexpected one year, and then made everybody go, "Are you sure? Are you mean? How do you know for sure someone has actually identified a species like that?"
There've been a couple bush tits. It's a very, very small bird. My wife and I found those one time out in Benson, in that wooded area right there near the Benson Church. And people didn't really believe it until other people went out. One time we also got a sora. So Keith Archibald and I were actually out there and west of 10th West and some of those marshlands. And we'd sort of taken a break and we were headed back to the car. And Keith says, "Wait a minute. I called that a Virginia rail, but it had a yellow bill." So that Virginia rails don't have yellow bills. So we went back and we were able to locate it, and it was a sora, also a rail, but a different species. I don't think we'd ever seen one on the count before.
Hmm. And I can say from experience, I mean, I've not been on the count itself, but going out with someone who's knowledgeable, my first redneck grebe was with Ivan Palmblad. Mm. Those of you that took class from Ivan here at USU, it was Discovering Nature. We were out in the Benson area, and like, wow, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And you get hooked. You it's just a lot of fun identifying the birds and then trying to see how many there are and what different ones that you can come up with that someone else maybe has not seen.
The fun thing about birds is that they are everywhere. So birding has become less of something that I do just to go birding, and more of something that's just incorporated into all the time when I'm out of doors. And even when I'm watching a movie or something, you know, I'll hear a bird or see a bird on the movie, and I'll say, "That's a," you know, whatever it is. Or riding down the road and on my motorcycle, even one of my life birds was from a motorcycle when Gene said, that's a magpie, but they don't have black-billed magpies here. It happened to be in California. That must be a yellow-billed magpie. So we turned around, and sure enough, that was
a
life bird for us. So they become a part of everything that you do when you're out of doors.
And you really get to know an area well if you're, to me, when you're out birding, I think of all the places where I've seen the birds, and I can almost in my mind tell you not only where I first saw the bird, but something about the area.
Sure.
So, for instance, I was in Vernal for a couple of weeks with the StoryCorps booth, and I went to the Ouray Wildlife Refuge. My first blue grosbeak will be because of going down there and just spending some time and enjoying the surroundings.
And when I see a bird for the first time, I record the date, of course, but I also record where I saw it and who I was with.
Mm.
So when I go back into my field guide where I make these notes, I can remember that day and where I was. And
I should start doing that. I haven't been putting down who I was with. I've got all the other identifying information, but
it adds a lot.
Well, this is a wonderful conversation about that, and I hope that that you as a listener will consider joining the Christmas bird count wherever you happen to be. There are a number of them throughout the state of Utah, and I have with me in studio Brian Dixon. He's compiler for the Logan Christmas Bird Count, a member of Bridgerland Audubon Bird Society, and a retired Environmental Society consultant. And thank you very much for coming in, Brian.
You're very welcome. My pleasure. Hope to see you all on the Christmas Bird Count.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams for the Petals and Prose section of the Zesty Garden. And I want to share some today about seasons in the garden because all of them are, three of them are so wonderful. And then we have winter, which is so important. And we all think, what do we do in winter with the garden besides read up on the seed catalogs? But that's an important part. I'm not going to talk to you today about reading the seed catalogs. I'm just going to talk about some of the things we do in some of the seasons that we really love. It actually ends with winter, so I almost couldn't be truthful to my opening statement. This comes from Gardening at the Dragon's Gate by Wendy Johnson, which if you've been listening long, you know is one of my favorite gardening manuals because it has not just instructions, but great little essays. And this is one of her fun little essays. She writes, "Summer is wild berry season on the California coast, the time when the Green Gulch kids migrate to the edge of the high summer garden to build secret blackberry forts. While the grones, as they call us, work harvesting butter lettuce and the last lavender of the season, Zen rascals guzzle ripe berries deep in the maze of summer. The kids do come up out of their blackberry thicket for high tea in the late afternoon. Hot, dirty, and scratched, and indigo blue with blackberry juice, they are hosed off and served iced lemon verbena tea, afloat with sprigs of black mint and anise hyssop blossoms. The garden crew bribes the kids into coming to tea. If they gather us a few baskets of wild blackberries early in the day, we'll make fruit tarts for tea time. We cajole them. No surprise, they agree. High tea is good at the end of a long day of making forts and living outside of Zen law. We all spoil our appetites for dinner with tiny fruit tarts made from wild blackberries mixed with dead ripe gooseberries and the last white currants of the season. After tea, we lie back in the grass and watch the evening clouds mount in the west, out over the ocean. The hills darken, russet and amber, and all the garden cranberry bean plants sag with the weight of August. The kids' parents are probably worried about where they are, but we are too lazy to move or be mildly responsible. Even when the first owls settle on the dark cypress limbs, we fail to budge. Young and old together, we are sated with full summer. But now that's past. In autumn, the ground is thirsty for rain, and by late October, Redwood Creek has dropped underground. Outside of the garden, the coast live oaks and huge tan oaks of the watershed ripen their acorns. The blue jays collect the first acorns of November, drilling them into the dry ground with their sharp beaks. Watching the jays work, I know it's time to begin my own harvest of acorns from oaks on the lower flanks of Mount Tamalpais that have been harvested for generations by the native Costa Noan tribes of the California Bay Area. As recently as 250 years ago, the Ohlone people who lived in the Redwood Creek watershed were hunter-gatherers who also farmed the land, cultivating the wild oaks. Particular oak trees were in the care of individual family groups for generations, in an era when time itself was linked to the seasons of the oak. the autumn harvest when tribes came together to celebrate by gleaning, gathering, and preparing food harvested from the oaks, marked the new year. Winter was measured in moon phases from the time of the acorn harvest. Spring was told by the flowering of the oaks, and summer was marked by the progression toward the ripening of the acorn harvest. 10,000 native people inhabited the 150 miles from the San Francisco Bay south to the Esalen Nation of Big Sur. The native people tended their trees faithfully. The first drop of acorns was usually riddled with acorn moth larvae. The Ohlone people covered these wormy acorns with dry grass and set the grass afire, destroying the primary larval phase of the oak pest. Then, when the healthy main season acorn drop occurred in early November, the fruit fell on a clean understory of savanna-like parkland beneath the huge oaks. There's an old story told by the Karuk people of Northern California about how the different species of oak came to earth. In the old days, acorns were sky maidens living in the heavens. Once, when there was famine on the earth, the sky maidens took pity and came down to be food. Valley Oak Girl dove down first, clapping her small gathering basket on her long, slender head. Her sister, Black Oak Maiden, wore her large burden basket, which is to this day her signature acorn cap. Next came tiny Coast Live Oak Girl with her small basket cap. And last of all, wearing her messy, rough burden basket cap, Tan Oak Maiden descended, becoming the richest food of all. Gathering acorns was a favorite autumn practice for my daughter and me for many years. I still gather acorns every autumn, and miraculously, my teenage daughter often helps. We take the acorns home, spread the good ones to dry behind our wood-burning stove. After a few days, we crack the acorns using a prized stone pestle. Though a mallet or hand pruners are equally effective, and we pry the acorn meat out of the shell. Every season we begin pounding the acorn meat by hand, but soon move to a modern food processor that whizzes the remainder of the acorn meat into a golden meal. Acorns are bitter in taste, rich in tannin and oil. Native people leached their acorn meal in slow-running river water to wash away the tannic acid. My modern adaptation is simple. I hang the acorn meal in cheesecloth pouches under a slow-dripping cold water tap overnight. Dark ochre tannin colors our old enamel sink a rich butternut gold every November. After it's leached, the acorn meal is laid to dry on clean towels before I toast it slowly in our oven until the kitchen smells like the inner kernel of the sunny oak forest. I mix the roasted meal with honey and fold in some fresh pumpkin pulp, adding whole wheat flour and a little baking soda to raise the bread. Every season, the acorn bread is a little different, depending on whim and fancy and what is at hand. If you want to do this, I was talking with our host of the Zesty Garden, Brian Earle, about where to find acorns. And I think although we don't have any wonderful live oaks or the other oaks that California does, we could still gather acorns from scrub oak in the mountains, and that might work. I would be willing to try it. If I find an acorn patch, I probably will. The basic ingredients for this, which she calls Thanksgiving acorn pumpkin bread, are 1 cup of whole wheat or white flour, 3/4 cup of acorn meal, 1 teaspoon salt, 1 1/4 cups of brown sugar, 2 teaspoons baking soda, and spices to taste. So that would be cinnamon, nutmeg, mace, whatever is your favorite spicy pumpkin bread spice. And for the wet ingredients, you need 1 cup of pumpkin pulp, which you can take from a can, or you can simply bake a small pumpkin, cut it open and scoop out the seeds and just measure pulp out of that. 1/3 cup of vegetable oil, 1/4 cup of water, and 2 eggs beaten. You combine the dry ingredients and you mix them together with the wet ingredients and then fold them in together into a well-oiled baking tin. Bake it at 350 for 50 to 60 minutes. And good luck with that. That's what I'd say. It says enjoy at the end, but I'm thinking if We, it might not be to our taste. Not much lost. Just a new learning experience. Wendy continues, I do not bake acorn bread on hot slabs of rock as the Ohlone people did. I am a modern kind of native to this earth, baking in a wolf oven as I keep the links to our watershed alive season after season. In early December, when winter unravels the organized garden, I want all work wound up, but winter's skein of ragged tasks lengthens as the days shorten. By the evening of the winter solstice, darkness drops well before 5 p.m., like iron shears cutting the last threads of the lit year. Yet every December, cold, wet soil calls me out of my warm house. I like to climb Coyote Ridge with a small clutch of kids and plant one-year-old fir and redwood seedlings in the shelter of shadowy north-facing canyons. From here, the willows down in the creek float in a copper haze against the steel-blue coastal range, and the sea and fields are one dark wash of green. When we finally come down from the headlands, we are cold and mean with hunger. We raid the winter garden for abandoned vegetables to make into soup. The forgotten rhubarb chard is still quite tender, its roots running in blood-red and tangled underground. At the back of the field, the rain-beaten remnants of my favorite leeks are still wearing clean white silk stockings under their mud-spattered wrapping leaves. We carry our treasures to the Zen Center kitchen and sauté the leeks with red garlic and cook the chard with tender yellow-flecked potatoes in a rich vegetable stock. Next, we puree the steaming winter vegetables into a thick, hearty soup and feast on the bounty of winter. The kids eagerly slurp down every last drop of soup, cleaning their bowls with slabs of freshly baked Norwegian rye bread spread with sweet butter. It's almost dark when we finish this winter feast. We have worked hard, and the headlands are anchored by more than a few hundred new trees this evening. As night falls outside the cold windows, I remember hidden treasure. Reaching into my coat pocket, I pull out a bright green bouquet of fir tips, collected that afternoon from young Douglas firs that we planted two seasons ago. Delight ripples through the throng, a fresh reason to stay together. Water is boiled and the fir tips are tossed into a teapot to steep, for 2 minutes only, into fragrant forest tea, rich in vitamin C. Chocolate chip cookies materialize as if by magic from the locked cookie cabinet that only 13-year-old Davy knows how to open with an unfaltering sleight of hand. Everyone looks the other way as Davy opens the forbidden door. Triumphant, he serves us cookies, while Elisa helps Sabrina pour hot fir-tip tea. We lift our steaming cups to the cold night and warm company. Love winter, wrote Thomas Merton, when the plants say nothing. And all the links that bind us to one another, to real food and the sleeping land, are alive and intertwined. Thanks for being with me. Enjoy our coming winter. Let's all cuddle up and drink fir-tip tea if we can find it. See you next time. This is Nancy Williams.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.